Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgeon Dr. Ryan Swan joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. He comes to us from Vassar Brothers Medical Center and the Dyson Center Care Center in Poughkeepsie. He's a one-of-a-kind, specializing in the surgical treatment of both malignant and benign diseases of the liver, bile ducts, and pancreas. Dr. Swan received his medical degree from Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit. He completed his surgical residency at Brown University and St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center at Columbia University. He completed fellowships in surgical research at Brown as well as the Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Swan, I know how busy you are. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I guess the first question I want to ask you is, we all keep hearing that getting pancreatic cancer is not a good thing, that they're harder to find, that people don't really discover them. So what are the signs that all of us, especially those of us who are hypochondriacs, should be looking for in terms of symptoms of pancreatic cancer?
Well, yeah, pancreatic cancer can be difficult to find. It's one of those diseases that we have a hard time screening for because it's rare and there's not a great test to screen for it. So we look for symptoms and signs. If the pancreas, the bile duct runs right through the pancreas. So if even a small tumor shows up next to the bile duct and compresses it, causes an obstruction, then you turn yellow and that's obvious. You go to your doctor.
You call that jaundice?
Jaundice, that yeah. Right. So yeah, if you develop jaundice, then that, not all jaundice is pancreatic cancer, but it needs to be investigated.
Right.
Other signs can be more subtle, pain in the upper part of the abdomen, weight loss that's unexplained. Sometimes in elderly patients who have never been diabetic and then they become diabetic with no real obvious reason, that's a subtle tip-off that there may be something in the pancreas.
Why would they become diabetic if they have pancreatic cancer?
So if you get a pancreas tumor that is obstructing the pancreatic duct and causing upstream atrophy of the pancreas, then you lose the insulin-producing cells over time.
So I get it.
That part of the pancreas can then die, and then you develop diabetes.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Jim from Matamora. So, okay, Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
I wonder if you have a plausible explanation of why a suspected mass in the MCH process of the pancreas would show up on three ultrasounds but would fail to appear on two CAT scans, a CT scan.
Well, pancreas masses can be difficult to pick up on a lot of different modalities, so usually ultrasound is the most difficult to pick it up. So if it showed up on an ultrasound and not a CT scan, that would be unusual. The CT scans can pick up most pancreatic masses down to about a centimeter in size. They're not always obvious. They're not bright like a light bulb. They're usually a darker spot in the pancreas. So sometimes you don't exactly see it clearly. It can be more diffuse. If there's a really strong suspicion, then an MRI is a little bit more sensitive. And then even past that, some of the procedures that the gastroenterologists do can pick it up.
Like, what are some of the procedures you guys do? Oh, the gastroenterologists do.
So if we have a really strong suspicion there's a pancreatic mass and we're not able to pick it up with CT, then endoscopic ultrasound is probably the next step. That's a procedure where the gastroenterologist goes in through the mouth, through the stomach with a scope that has an ultrasound on it. And through the back of the stomach, they're basically right on top of the pancreas.
But many of us are told that it's very hard to find pancreatic cancers because of where it's located in the body, and basically they get sort of hidden. But we do so many preemptive things against things like, you know, colon cancer. Everybody gets their colonoscopy every 5 years. Should we be doing more of that for the pancreas?
Yeah, so pancreatic screening, I get asked that question a lot. When somebody finds something, they say, how come we didn't find this earlier? And it's a matter of having a test that's easy to do and cost-effective and a disease that's prevalent enough that you find it frequently enough to justify the screening. And right now, we don't have a good screening method.
Uh-huh. Well, you've just gone through a list of things that you can use to find a mass, right? You know, the CT or the other procedures. But those are not fiscally affordable. Is that?
Well, I mean, they're affordable. It's just finding the population of people that would benefit from screening them. Just like anything else, you do colon cancer screening for people over age 50, and so defining a patient population that's high enough risk for pancreatic cancer that you would screen them is really the trick.
And but we haven't even done that, have we?
We don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. Jim, thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. All right. And we'll go to Bill in Gloversville, but not before I give the number. I'll tell you, there's only one person on the phone. That's Bill from Gloversville, 1-800-348-2551. Get in line now. All right. Let's go to line one. Okay, Bill, you're on.
Doctor, I have heard that half an hour of aerobic exercise 3 to 4 times a week, coupled with vitamin C and drinking bottles of distilled water as opposed to tap water, will decrease your chances of contracting cancer. Do you concur with this?
Well, I don't know about, well, first of all, Bill, thanks for calling. I don't know about the combination. You know, you could take each of those things and look at them individually, but I haven't heard of that combination specifically. You know, exercise goes along with other things like obesity and diabetes, and that's a whole field that's just sort of burgeoning. Obesity has been found to be associated with a lot of cancers, pancreas cancer and liver cancer being two of the highest risk ones. The vitamin C, I don't know. Certainly possible. And I've heard, you know, I've had a lot of patients come in and say distilled water or alkaline water has been touted as a cancer cure. I think it's out there. I don't know how well it's been studied in randomized, you know, fashion.
So Bill in Gloversville, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Very quickly, we'll go to Leslie in Albany. Okay, Leslie, you are on. Go ahead, Leslie.
Hi there. I have a quick question for you. Might be a little unusual. My father is 87 years old, and he has all the symptoms you just listed a moment ago, the pain in the abdomen, weight loss, borderline diabetes. However, he's had MRIs, CAT scans, and now a biopsy that has shown he does not have pancreatic cancer. So a little bit unusual question is, what are some of the possibilities you may know of that have those symptoms that are not cancer?
Well, thanks for calling, Leslie. So this can be a conundrum. You know, pain in the upper abdomen can come from a lot of things. There's things inside the pancreas and outside. So, you know, there can be simple things like gastritis or ulcer disease of the stomach that gives you pain in the same area.
Okay.
Sometimes inside the pancreas, people can have chronic scarring of the pancreas that can cause pain can even cause inflammatory changes, scarring of the pancreas that can sometimes even look like a mass, but it's just a chronic inflammation. So it can be really a challenge and frustrating to find out exactly what's causing the pain. But yeah, you're right. I mean, not everybody who has upper abdominal pain and borderline diabetes has pancreas cancer. I don't want to scare everybody out there who's listening.
No. Then and there's a mass there, and they did a biopsy, and it's not carcinogenic. So. Okay. He's at a loss, and I just kind of wanted to give him some possibilities to investigate.
If there is a mass there, then it depends. So the imaging, you know, there's a lot of different types of imaging. I think MRI can sometimes shed a little more light on it. And the biopsies are for pancreas tumors are not always, you don't always catch it. I tell patients sometimes it's like throwing a dart at a dartboard. Sometimes you hit red and sometimes you hit black. And because the biopsy is negative doesn't mean it's not there. So sometimes if I have a really strong suspicion there's a cancer there, I'll get another biopsy, and usually via that endoscopic ultrasound that I was talking about.
Leslie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
We're going to take a short break. Now, if you want to get in, you know, this is an incredible opportunity to find out about things. So we'll come right back.
Support comes from the Hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, healthquest.org for locations. NBT Bank offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. HPA LiveWell, Albany, New York, providing a spectrum of psychological services, including individuals and family counseling, ADHD testing, multicultural counseling, treatment for eating disorders, and more. AlbanyHPA.com. The Black Sheep, downtown Amherst, a New York-style delicatessen and European-style all-butter scratch bakery, caterer, and cafe offering fair trade coffee. BlackSheepDeli.com. And from Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, plastic surgery dedicated to cosmetic surgery, laser treatments, and minimally invasive facial rejuvenation. Since 1996, Surgeon's Hands, A Woman's Touch, CAPEK, PlasticSurgery.com.
So we're talking to Dr. Ryan Swan about pancreatic surgery, and liver surgery, and bile surgery, and it's got to be a tough thing to do because this is such a devastating disease that when patients come to you, they need a lot of reassurance.
Yeah,
that's a question, I think, somewhere in there.
That's true. It is. It's a tough field, and most people who come in the office, I usually tell people, you know, nobody wants to see me. Usually, you're having one of the worst days of your life when you show up.
Sure, that's true. Okay, we heard over the internet at WAMC.org. Can you talk about the prognosis for pancreatic cancer? In other words, what's the survival rate?
Well, pancreatic cancer, it's one of the more dreaded cancers out there. Part of that is because it is, as we've discussed, it's hard to find. And most people, when they do find out that they have it, about 85% of patients, it's already spread outside the pancreas. And once it's spread, then the treatments are not surgical. They're usually medical with chemotherapy. The chemotherapy for pancreas cancer has gotten a lot better in the last 5 years, I would say, but it's still not great.
Well, I noticed you haven't given the survival rate. What is it?
So if it's metastatic, it's still five years is still low, like in the 5% range.
Yeah.
If we get through surgery, so if we're lucky enough, you're in the 15% of people where we catch it, and we catch it early enough, we can take it out with one of the surgical procedures.
The so-called Whipple procedure.
Right, the Whipple procedure, or if it's on the other side, a distal pancreatectomy, then usually people go on to get chemo afterwards, sometimes radiation. So then, and sometimes they get it ahead of time, but usually, you know, the five-year survival in that group, if once you kind of run the gauntlet of getting through all that stuff is around 20-30%. Still not beautiful numbers.
No, indeed. Okay, yeah. we'll go to Tom in Sheffield. Okay, Tom, asking a very important question. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, folks. Thanks for having this this subject. I lost my dad to pancreatic cancer, so I'm mostly interested in any hereditary recurrence. And if I may just follow up before I hang up, a kid named Jake Andraka 15-year-old kid came up with a test. I saw a TED talk about it a couple years ago. Haven't heard anything since. I wondered if you could comment.
Thanks, Tom. So as far as the hereditary question, the vast majority of pancreatic cancers that we see are not hereditary. Most of them are sporadic, and the risk factors that we know about are pretty limited. We know smoking is a risk factor, like it's a risk factor for a lot of things.
How much of a risk factor? You know, I got some people around that I know who smoke a lot.
Yeah.
They seem to ignore all this stuff. And we hear smoking is bad, but how bad?
Well, it's bad in that for a lot of reasons. But as far as for cancer, though, it's the biggest risk that it poses is for lung cancer, obviously.
Yeah, sure.
But the other cancers, like pancreatic cancer, it's a slightly increased risk. It's not top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
Other things, chronic pancreatitis can predispose people to pancreatic cancer.
And titus, as opposed to cancer, is just inflammation. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So I wouldn't worry too much about it being hereditary, because of your father. The overwhelming majority, it's not. And in the few cases where it is hereditary, there are some syndromes, but most likely not associated.
Well, doctor, is it age related too? I mean, the older you get, the more likely you are to get the disease.
For pancreatic cancer, that's a disease that is most common in the 60s and 70s. But I've certainly had patients with pancreatic cancer in their 30s and 40s.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for calling, Tom. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Joanna in South Hadley. Okay, Joanna, you're on.
Hi there. I met a woman this last year who was in her 40s who became a living organ donor and gave part of her liver to someone, and it saved the person's life, and it's the first time I'd ever heard about that. Does the doctor have any comments on this in terms of how old or young people should be to sign up for something like this, and any thoughts about it? Because I wasn't aware people could give part of their liver to someone else.
Yeah, thanks, Joanna. I mean, that's one of the most altruistic things that somebody can do, and it certainly can be done. That's a living-related liver donor donation is becoming more common, and it's important because the alternative is cadaveric liver transplant, which comes from someone who donated their liver when they die, and there's always a limited supply. So that's the major limiting factor for liver transplant out there, is that there's just not enough organs.
So are you telling us that a liver will replace itself, basically can grow?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I
the
don't
liver,
think that's something a lot of us know. Yeah.
Yeah. The liver. So you only have one liver, and you need to treat it well. But if you have part of it taken out, or if you donate part of it, the remaining part, the liver remnant, we call it, that you're keeping, in about a month will grow to replace almost the entire volume that you had taken out.
So why do you need a donor if what's left will grow again?
Well, so for diseases where the liver becomes scarred up, like cirrhosis, or some of the hereditary diseases of the liver where it's just not functioning. Once the liver starts to scar up, it doesn't have that regenerative capacity anymore, and that's where liver transplant
comes in. And cirrhosis is often identified, perhaps incorrectly, perhaps not, with drinking?
Yeah, so cirrhosis and alcohol.
As long as we mentioned smoking before.
We should get alcohol in there too. So, excessive alcohol use is associated with cirrhosis, and that's one of the major risk factors. And here in the U.S., the other major one is the hepatitis C, which really peaked in the 70s and 80s.
And what is it? I know it can be sexually transmitted, right, hepatitis C?
Yeah.
And what is it?
Well, hep C is mostly bloodborne. So there's hepatitis B as well. But hep C is more common here in the U.S. It's a virus. It lives in the liver. It can be latent there for long periods of time. And it causes chronic inflammation. Chronic inflammation over many years causes scarring. And then that can lead to cirrhosis.
Is there any way to diagnose whether or not you're at risk?
For cirrhosis?
Yeah.
Well, so for hepatitis C, people who are at risk should be tested. So if you've ever had, if you had a blood transfusion before the 1980s, basically when they started testing for it, or history of IV drug use, those are the major risk factors. If you pick it up now, there is a new medication out that is potentially curative as of last year for hepatitis C.
Joanna, you want to come back with anything?
So I guess as a final thought, do you encourage people to look into becoming possible living organ donors? What's your thoughts?
I would. It's a huge decision to make, and you know, usually people have a family member or a friend who they want to donate to. To do it to a anonymous, to a stranger, is something that is amazing, but I'm not sure how many people would do it. It has to be done at a center that does a fair number, because when you're taking somebody who's doing that for someone else, you really can't have a complication. It has to go well.
Joanna, thank you for your call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Right. Okay, so now we'll go to Joan in Schenectady. And Joan is the only one on the line right now, I can tell you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Go, Joan. Joan.
Hello?
Hello, Joan, you're on.
Yes, I'm here. Yep, thanks for taking my call. 62-year-old female, family history of pancreatic cancer, so I have been monitored by MRIs for the past 5 years. In the last year, they noted a 50% shrinkage in the pancreatic tail. Since then, I've had a CAT scan, an endoscopic ultrasound, and blood work. There's no indication of a growth or tumor, only that there is this shrinkage in the tail of the pancreas. Just wondering if you have any thoughts as to other tests or reasons for this shrinkage and what else might be causing it, because at this point, there's nothing definable as to why the shrinkage is occurring.
Sure. Thanks, Joan. So that's a difficult scenario. So when you see, that's called pancreatic atrophy, there has to be a reason for it. Either the blood supply to that area got cut off, which is not common, or the pancreatic duct is blocked by something, so it's causing pressure on the duct upstream, and that over time causes the tissue around the duct to shrink and die. So when we see that, we suspect that there may be something there at the junction between shrunk pancreas and normal pancreas, to the point where when all the tests come out negative, if you're very suspicious, depending on how healthy you are and where it is and what type of operation, sometimes we would take out an area like that in order to rule out a malignancy.
So you're talking about surgically removing something at that interface between where it has shrunk and where it's still normal?
Sure, yeah. So, again, you know, none of these pancreatic operations are, they're not small, so... you have to have something that's persistent, and you really have to run the whole line of tests. But if it's something that's persistent and concerning looking, the goal in my mind is to not miss a malignancy. So if I see something that could have been caused like pancreatic ductal obstruction or pancreatic atrophy, and we've talked about it with the gastroenterologist and we've gone through all the tests, I would consider taking out that part in order to catch it early, because, you know, as we've discussed, once pancreatic malignancies grow, they tend to spread even when they're fairly small.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for your input. I appreciate that.
Sure, no problem.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Jason in Albany. All right, Jason, your turn.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hey.
So the reason I'm calling is I was 35 years old, from a family with no history of diabetes, but at the age of 35, I got diagnosed as type 1 diabetic. I've been through tests over the last 6 years now, trying to figure out what's going on. At times, the pancreas seems to rejuvenate and work sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't. So that's why they would say I'm more of a 1.5 diabetic. And some of my concern over the years is that there's something going on with my pancreas that's undiagnosed. But I mean, we do the blood test every 3 months with the endocrinologist, and nothing alarming has shown up. I was just interested in your thoughts on that. Could there be an underlying issue? And should I seek out to a doctor like yourself and at least be tested and looked at? So I'll take the answer off the air.
Don't do that. Don't do that. He may have a question. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay.
Doc. So thanks for calling, Jason. So, you know, type 1 diabetes is a different entity than the diabetes that we see from an underlying blockage of the pancreas or something like that. That's type 1 diabetes is an actual autoimmune issue. So you can have atrophy of the entire pancreatic gland over time from your body's reaction to it, which is a totally separate issue. It doesn't mean there's an underlying mass or a malignancy or anything like that. So, you know, I think maybe something to look at with a CT scan or an MRI, but I wouldn't be too concerned about an underlying cancer there.
Jason, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. All right, let's go to Dave in Ulster County. Okay, Dave, you're on.
Hey, folks, thanks for taking my call. You know, I tuned in a little late, but I heard you talking about the hepatitis C epidemic and the treatment for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, back in the 90s, I went in for a simple cholesterol test, and when the cholesterol test came back, they found that my liver enzymes were off the chart, and that's how I got referred to a gastroenterologist. Find out that I did contract hepatitis C, and I had never gotten any inoculations that I know of that would have caused it, or stuck a needle in my arm from drug use. But what my gastroenterologist did inform me of is that it is well known now that intranasal usage can also cause it. Like if you were a cocaine user, as I was, and I use it regularly, that's how I caught. The virus, and or actually the disease, and I went on the interferon ribavirin treatment because that was the only treatment way back then. I had to go on it for over a year, and it was painful because I was walking around with flu-like symptoms every day. But I was cured. I was a low percentile that was successful, and I was cured. And okay. I can't emphasize more that, you know, drug use of needles, et cetera, isn't the only way that you get it. And whether your listeners know that or not,
sure.
There's a lot of cocaine users out there. And it's just by snorting the cocaine intranasal and sharing that straw.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Dave, we want to get an answer from the doctor. A lot of people behind you. Go ahead, Dave. Doctor.
Thanks.
Well, thanks, Dave. I appreciate you bringing that up. It's a virus that is bloodborne and can be contracted from blood. So I suppose if you're given it a route of entry and you're sharing something, so a route of transit, then yes, it could be transmitted.
What do you mean sharing?
Oh, like sharing needles.
Well, he said no needle, but what if somebody, you know, I don't really know how that thing works, I'll be honest with you, but somebody snorts it. In a little spoon, you see that on some of the social media, and then hands the same spoon to the next guy.
I guess if you have open area, you know, in your nose, and somebody else has the same thing, and you're sharing the same snorting device, then you could probably share the hepatitis C too.
Interesting. Got it, Dave.
Thanks for
there you
thanks.
Got it. I just wanted to let people know out there.
I'm glad you did, and thank you for your honesty, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Nina in Montgomery. All right, Nina is on line number 4. Okay, Nina, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 31-year-old daughter who has been diagnosed with chronic pancreatitis for the past 7 years now. And she controls it the best she can with diet, but there are times when it gets acute, and she has three-day to two-month hospital stays. And my question to Dr. Swan is, Is there any newer treatments? I know it is something that can lead to pancreatic cancer. The treatments that she's using right now is pain and nausea controls, and she's working full-time. She knows others that are on disability because of it.
Yeah, thanks, Nina. So chronic pancreatitis is really an underappreciated and devastating disease, and I've had a lot of patients with similar stories as your daughter. I think it gets under, it doesn't get the recognition that it deserves as an illness. And sometimes it gets, people get a little, I guess, put down because it is associated with alcohol. And so, you know, people see it as a disease that maybe, you did to yourself, which is really not the case.
It's not the case, for sure.
Yeah. So,
you surgically remove the pancreas to stop that?
Well, in some cases. So there's some subtleties there. So if there's the pancreas has a long duct that runs down the middle of it, and if the duct gets scarred up or blocked, then it can create stones. It's sort of like a vicious circle. The stones block the duct more, so you get more duct dilation. The duct dilation causes more inflammation. So if there's a dilated duct, there's more things that can be done procedurally or surgically than if there's not. So if the duct's dilated, sometimes a gastroenterologist can put a stent into the duct. If that makes her feel better, then it gives you an idea that that blocked duct has something problem. To do with her pain. Stents don't last forever. They're very small, and so they have to be changed out. And eventually, you know, the gastroenterologist will say, okay, go see the surgeon in that case. Some of the procedures that we do, we open the pancreatic duct up all the way along the pancreas, and then we bring the intestine up and we sew it onto that. It's called a lateral pancreatic jejunostomy or a Pousteau procedure. And in certain patients, that's very helpful. There are other instances where there's a dominant mass of inflammation in the head or the tail or something like that. And so sometimes taking out part of that pancreas is helpful. The real challenge is where the pancreas is diffusely diseased, but the duct's not dilated. There's no focal area where it looks worse than others.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real challenge. And so some centers, and I'm not one of those centers as of yet, but there are some centers that do total pancreatectomy.
With the islet cells.
Exactly. Yeah, they do the islet cell transplant. So you can be considered for that when it's early enough in the process, if it looks like it's going to be longstanding, where your insulin-producing cells still work. So pancreatitis, if it goes on for a decade or so and it kind of burns the pancreas out and the insulin cells stop working, then the islet cell transplant doesn't work as well because they're already burned out. So that might be something to consider if she's not diabetic yet. Maybe, you know, at least a consultation with a center that does that.
Nina, I am so sorry, but we've got to take off for a little bit of a break. I thank
okay.
you for calling. Appreciate
well,
it
thank
very
you
much.
Very much.
Thanks,
yeah.
Nina.
Okay, we'll take a break right now. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. The Urological Institute of Community Care Physicians, a team of four uro-oncologists with 75 years of combined experience providing advanced robotic surgery for kidney, bladder, and prostate cancer, urologyoncology.com. Foxgloves Garden Gloves, made with performance sport materials designed for gardening, birding, hiking, and many outdoor activities. Machine washable, foxglovesgardengloves.com. Ellis Medicine, working to create a culture that helps nurses professionally and personally. EllisNurses.org for more information. And from Wash and Wag Pet Grooming Salon, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, professionally trained groomers, organic, natural products, no cage drying, Facebook and 866-WASH-WAG.
We are back with Dr. Ryan Swan, who handles, you know, pancreatic surgery and liver surgery and duct surgery. He's a guy who does it all, and it's not an easy job. And I want to thank you on behalf of all of us for doing it, because it's
thanks for
important.
Having me.
Okay, let's go to Bob in Conesville. It says here Conesville. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Hi, Alan. Hi, Dr. Swan.
Hey, Bob.
I had a feeling of fullness just below my rib area, slightly to the left of center. And my doctor had me do an ultrasound of that area both last year and this year. And the fullness comes and goes. It's not constant, and it's not really painful. And also, I'm wondering, I have a rash that develops on and off in that same area. Is that a symptom of a problem with the pancreas? And what's the next step that I should take after the ultrasound show no problem?
Well, so I don't know exactly if the feeling of fullness and the rash go together. Usually a rash is not really associated with the pancreas.
Right.
So that's a little bit different. But the sense of fullness, there are a few other things up in that area. The stomach's up there, the top part of the colon. So, you know, if ultrasound hasn't really shown anything and then things persist, you might want to move on to maybe a CT scan.
CT scan?
Yeah. And how old are you?
70. I'll be 73 Tuesday.
Okay, and then so you should have had a colonoscopy or two in your life too at this point. Have you had? If you haven't,
the last one I had was I think it was 5 years ago.
Right. So if that was okay, then you're probably clear there. And then you know you might want to consider with your doctor, if this is a persistent thing, maybe an upper endoscopy to look in the stomach.
Uh huh. Okay. So I would go to my gastroenterologist?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Bob, thank you for the call. Appreciate
thank
it very
you.
Much.
Thanks,
yeah?
Bob.
Okay.
Okay, we'll go to Tracy in Rotterdam. Okay, Tracy in Rotterdam, you're on.
Thank you. I have two questions. I have a friend who was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she is now at stage 4 breast cancer. And what we find as her cancer sort of takes up shop in different parts of her body, that you know we'll hear that it is so. Most recently, there was a tumor in the duct for the pancreas, and we both looked at each other and we were said, "Gosh, what does the pancreas do?" And so I think that this is a common occurrence with people. I mean, if you've been out of school for a long time and you know biology 101 is a distant memory, I would love the doctor to just explain, please, what the pancreas does, because it seems to do so many things. And then my other question is, how common is it for breast cancers to metastasize to the pancreas or to the duct?
Well, thanks, Tracy. So, I think that's a good idea. We can go over what the pancreas does. So, most of the time, you don't know it's there and you don't feel it, and people forget about it until it causes a problem. So the pancreas runs through the back of the abdomen, and it's a long, skinny organ. On the right side, it has what we call the head, and then the left side is the body and the tail. It's got a long duct that runs down the middle of it where the pancreas tissue puts juices that go into the intestine to help you break down food, specifically protein and fat. So that's part of the function. But it's also it also has a lot of other cells nested in it that do things like control your blood sugar. Is the main thing. So it makes insulin, and it makes the opposite of insulin. It's called glucagon. It has several other minor functions in the GI tract as well. Does that cover it?
And then just is it a common target area for breast cancers that metastasize?
No, or not really. Pretty rare for something to spread to the pancreas. So, renal cell carcinoma from the kidney tends to go to the pancreas for some reason. We don't know why.
Okay.
But breast cancer going to the pancreas is pretty rare, I think.
But it could be that the pancreas itself is metastatically been transferred to, right? I mean, you can get pancreatic cancer from another site?
It's pretty rare for something else to spread to the pancreas. The pancreas usually spreads elsewhere.
Got it. Thanks for that.
Trace. I think that's one of the confusing things, that when somebody starts out with one type of cancer and then it travels, I think it gets a little confusing as you get into these later stages about, you know, sort of the origins and then how they're treated and that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
So any information is great. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Tracy.
No problem.
All right. We'll go to Liz in Hopewell. Okay, Liz, you're up.
Oh, hi, Dr. Swan. Thank you for taking me.
Sure.
I have a sister, well, I had a sister-in-law. She was 64 years old. She started having back problems. She went to the doctor, and they diagnosed her with bile duct cancer. Okay. And the doctor was a little crude. He told her to go home, take care of your wife, and you'll be dead within 4 months. She really didn't accept that, so she did go to the Mayo Clinic, and sure enough, they did diagnose it. They said there was no cure, and there is no treatment for it. My question to you is, and by the way, she did die within 4 months. My question to you was, could she have had a liver transplant? Because I heard you say that that helps with some of the cancers. So that is my question.
Sure. So liver transplant for bile duct cancer is pretty rare. There are a couple centers, I think Mayo is one of them, actually, where they'll do it, but it's for very small tumors that are just in a very bad spot. So the liver has what's called the hilum, where all the blood flow and the bile duct comes in from underneath. And if you get a bile duct tumor that's there, it can be the size of an almond but still not be removable because of what it's pushing up against. It's important. So in some of those situations, they'll do liver transplants, but it's very, very selective. Liver transplant is done for liver cancers that start in the liver, not the bile duct. That's called hepatocellular carcinoma. That's a different entity.
And go over this one more time. The bile duct is not usually a primary site for cancers.
The bile duct can develop cancer. So the bile duct runs, it starts up in the liver. It's like a tree. Up in the liver is the branches. The trunk runs down between the liver and the intestine, and it goes through the pancreas on its way down there. Cancer can develop in any one of those parts.
Huh, interesting. Liz, thanks for your call. Appreciate it very much.
I just had one more thing. And
sure.
They did try to give her, because, you know, so young, they tried to give her chemotherapy. She became violently ill. And he said that there's really nothing that they can do for bile duct cancer. It's very rare. Is that true? Is it very rare cancer?
It's pretty rare, and the chemo is not really great yet for it. So what we usually try to do is, if it's removable, if it can be cut out, either by taking out part of the liver or taking out the bile duct and part of the liver, if it's removable and hasn't spread, then that's what we try to do.
So how do you replace it if you take out the bile duct?
So if we have to take just the bile duct out, we have to sew something up to the liver so it can drain. So we divide the intestine. And we bring a limb of intestine up, we call it a Roux-en-Y, and then we reconnect the intestine further down. So we basically make a limb of intestine that we can put on to the liver, and we sew it directly onto the bile ducts.
That's unbelievable. Thank you, Liz. Okay, let's go to Leo in Shelburne Falls. Okay, Leo, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a 12-year-old grandson who's a type 1 diabetic, and I'm trying to look into the crystal ball of the future of treatments, and is there anything coming down the pike in the way of stem cells, or I've heard of beta cells, transplants, artificial pancreas? And can you talk about what the future might hold?
Well, thanks, Leo, for calling. This is a difficult area, and you know, they've done pancreatic transplants for situations like this. Again, that's an operation that it's got a lot of side effects and things. So as we get better with things like insulin pumps that continually read your blood sugar, that's probably how it's going to go. But it's really a little outside of my my wheelhouse.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you,
Leo.
Thanks, Bob.
All right. Leo. We'll go to Alex in Amherst. Okay. Alex, you're on.
Hey, Doc. I had a quick question. Just a medical question, really, in general.
Sure.
What's the difference between non-reactive and negative, considering the value and the final status of your medical needs from your doctor?
You mean as far as how a test is reported?
Yeah.
So non-reactive usually means negative. So specifically, you know, if it's a viral test, you know, like we were talking earlier about hepatitis B and C, when they report it as non-reactive, that means negative.
Okay, Alex?
Okay, I didn't really support any question I really had. I mean, just say you had, you know, hep C, HIV, or HSV, and it all came up non-reactive. Non-detected, that means it's not in your system?
Well, non-detected...
you'll never have it, or you'll never get it, what?
Yeah, so it usually means... So non-reactive means they ran the test and that your blood didn't react with the test. So that's usually a negative. If you know you have hepatitis C and then they come back as you get a report that says non-detected, that usually means that they're looking at how many, what's the viral load. And then if it's non-detected, it means you've had a, you know, a good response to treatment. So those are a little different.
Okay.
Thanks, Alex. Okay, we'll go to Margo in Chatham. Okay, Margo, you're on.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, Margo.
Hi. My brother has stage 3 pancreatic cancer. He's 67 and was not operable. He's had chemo 7 rounds. It did not reduce the size of the tumor. Hmm. Now he's doing proton radiation.
Okay.
And I wondered if you could tell me the difference between proton radiation and regular old radiation.
Sure. So so stage 3, so it must have been involving some of the vessels to make it non-operable. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So proton radiation is just, it's a little bit different form of radiation. It is what it sounds like. It, instead of the electrons that they're using to radiate, they're actually firing the protons at the tumor. As far as the effect goes, it's been touted as being effective for a lot of different types of cancer. For pancreas, I've had a few patients look into it and I've researched it. We didn't do it where I've been. I don't think it's really that well studied yet as to is it any better than regular radiation.
Yeah, well, I don't have a lot of hope for it either, but
yeah,
they're also giving him some new chemotherapy that's just being tested, but
sure,
he's not part of the trial.
Yeah, so that's another way to go. I mean, if it's not operable, then you know, get in another opinion where you may be eligible for trials is one thing.
So are there any promising trials coming up?
Well, maybe in combination with other things like radiation. So a lot of the immunotherapy that we've heard about is promising for a lot of different types of cancer, but pancreas cancer is proving to be a little more resistant than
usual.
So
I'm sorry, Doc, do you want to go to a place like, you know, a major cancer hospital, or, you know, what's the protocol for?
Well, he's at the University of Pennsylvania, so I think
right,
it's a good place.
Right. Yeah. So if they have a clinical trial there, that might be something to look into. Another thing that some places around the country have started doing for locally advanced pancreatic cancer that's not metastatic is to do what's called IRE. I don't know if they've mention that. It's a way of killing the tumor around the vessels and then taking out the rest.
Hey, Margo, we got to let you go because we're out of time. Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
okay.
Margo.
Bye-bye.
As I've just said, we are just about out of time and we didn't leave anybody on the line, and that's miraculous. Underwriting support for Vox Pop comes from Northeast Solar in Hatfield, Massachusetts, helping Pioneer Valley residents live more sustainably with solar power for home, business, or farm. Keep solar local, northeast-solar.com. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Beloy, and our new Diggs. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.